hi everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. I'm your host for this week, Tommy Wiseau. This week we are looking at greatest movie ever made, The Room, directed by me, Tommy Wiseau, and the film it inspired, The Disaster Artist, directed by James Franco, my good friend. Returning on the show today to talk about these movies, Professor Mary Dutter. Oh, hi, Professor Dutter.
Oh, hi, Tommy. How are you?
Pretty good. Okay, I'll stop it. But when you really think about, like, as I just watched The Room again yesterday, it's like a twisted American dream story. Immigrant, he's from Eastern Europe.
From New Orleans.
Yeah, he's totally from New Orleans.
He's
finally admitted he's from Eastern Europe. So, guy from Eastern Europe comes to San Francisco. He kind of does like these odd jobs in the book they talk about, a disaster artist. So he works at a place called Straight Fashions USA. Somehow amasses this big fortune where he can put $6 million in to make his own independent movie.
Yeah.
Even though the movie is absolutely terrible in every way, he goes on and becomes this huge cult fanatic film, which just has this huge following all around the world. He probably has a lot of money due to this one film, and he's a star. Anybody who's into film knows who Tommy Wiseau is, and it's sort of just like, it's like a twisted version of the American dream. Yes, the film is awesome, but only in America can you make a terrible movie and then make a living on it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's an important thing that you note here, because a lot of times when people talk about The Room, they usually, in the same breath, bring up other really bad movies like Birdemic and Troll 2 and Sharknado. But the biggest difference between those things is that they knew when they were making Sharknado that this was Troll 2 or Birdemic.
Troll 2, I'll contend. The guy who directed it still thinks it's a good movie.
Okay. But with The Room, they were. These are two guys, Tommy Wiseau and
Greg Sestero,
who have seen plenty of movies. They know what a good movie looks like. And, of course, they've never really been in film production before, so...
Yeah, reading the book, because there's a book I highly recommend called The Disaster Artist, which was written by Greg Sestero, who plays Mark in The Room, and he was good friends with Tommy Wiseau, and he wrote about how his experience, how he became friends with Tommy Wiseau, and how he, during the making of The Room, and Greg was kind of a struggling actor, but he kind of he talked about during this time before The Room was being made, he appeared in he had a cameo in Patch Adams.
Oh, okay.
He was like an extra in Gattaca, played a small role in like ER or some hospital TV show or soap opera. And he actually had a starring role in some, cheap movie called Puppet Master 4 or something. So
okay.
He had this role, and I think because he was getting some looks in Hollywood, I think in the book, I'll talk more about it, but it was sort of like Wiseau became jealous of him. That almost spurred him on to do something for himself.
Okay, Greg Sestero had at least some experience with, this is what a film set looks like, this is what... that a production looks like. And so with Tommy Wiseau going into this, the thing is, we're going to be probably going back and forth here between Disaster Artist and The Room a bit, because so much of Disaster Artist informs what you see when you look at The Room. But when they go into the production company to buy all the equipment, not to rent, and which is common practice because it's so expensive.
But by the time you buy it, like 3 or 4 years after you buy it, it's going to become completely outdated.
Right. Yeah. So and the fact that they shot it in analog and digital at the same
which makes
time,
no sense.
Yeah, and just the kinds of things they're asking for. The guys that are selling them this stuff and eventually say, okay, well, we'll cut you a great deal on all this stuff as long as you make the picture here. So Greg Sestero obviously doesn't know the producer side of things. If you're just showing up as an actor on a soundstage for a day, you're learning your lines, you're doing this and that. You know camera work, things like that, boom, mics. But as far as what goes into actually making a movie, these two are fish out of water. They know what a movie looks like, but as far as how do you put one together, what are the nuts and bolts that are associated with that? They have maybe a cursory knowledge, from the acting side of things, but so it watching them go through and having to make like some of the choices, the fact that the alley outside is what they base the soundstage on. Well, it's like, well, why don't we just shoot the alley outside? No, we're not going to do that. And, you know, so they've got all these green screens all around to shoot what is naturally occurring 20 feet away from them.
And even in the book, they talk about how they were shooting on that lot of Burns and Sawyer, and they had a rooftop which they could shoot on.
Yeah.
But instead of shooting on that rooftop for the rooftop scenes in the movie, they shoot it in a green screen studio.
Right. It's just, it's absolutely mind-boggling the things that they, even when they are being told by the Seth Rogen character and some of the other people that are professionals in this industry and saying, you know, yeah, you sure you want to do that? And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's exactly what we want to do.
And they're like, just, okay, sure.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we'll go ahead and do it. And I also love the whole when Seth Rogen goes to cash the paycheck at the bank.
And that happened.
Oh, yeah?
The guy, go ahead, though.
Oh, yeah, but so he goes, and he's totally expecting this to bounce because this has been such a Mickey Mouse operation ever since he's shown up for day one. And he's totally shocked that, oh, my gosh, there is money in this account. And according to the guy that's working at the bank, he's like, it's just a bottomless pit.
Yeah.
And Seth Rogen's like, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and ride this pony because I'm getting paid.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's the thing, like, the character of Seth Rogen was based on a guy called Sandy, I forget his last name. And that guy was a professional in the business, the first director of photography, because they don't talk about in the movie, but he fired like two other people before.
I'm sure.
That guy had worked on television. Sandy actually worked with Janusz Kaminski, Steven Spielberg's cinematographer. And actually in the book, he had this, they talk about one day he comes up, Tommy comes up in the set and Sandy's kind of got this big smile on his face. He goes, Tommy, I'm really sorry, but I got this. I'm working with Kaminski. I gotta go. And Tommy was like, whatever. Was like, but it's Kaminski. I gotta leave. And so Sandy takes the job because he's finally happy he can quit this job.
He's out of this dog and
pony
show. But
like, these are guys that, you know, maybe not like the, you know, household names or anything like that, but they're professionals in the business, so they have some competency in knowing what they're doing. And was so working with these guys could have made, you know, it's amazing that this is the product, even when he's working with professionals in the business.
Yeah, but he has so much hubris of his own that he's unwilling to kind of compromise on any of the on most of the things that he thinks he wants to go with, like the setting up interior sets that mirror the exterior that is just right outside. And it's really, for people that don't know the room, you will still get entertainment out of watching The Disaster Artist, just if you're interested in movies and movie making. From, you know, the multiple takes of, you know, I did not hit her.
I did not hit her.
And how he can't land that line. And the whole time that I'm seeing that, I was thinking back to things like how many times Marilyn Monroe had to say certain lines in Some Like It Hot, and how they just had to keep doing it and doing it and doing it over and over and over again. And how and Greg Sestero is the one that gives them the water bottle. If you've ever been wondering why he is throwing a water bottle, that is his thing to kind of focus and channel in. And it's only after he gets that water bottle that he's able to do those lines.
And they talk, and it showed in the movie a little bit, but in the book he says, like, this scene took us, like, that one scene, the I did not hit her, I did not, which for the entire movie takes about, like, maybe 5 seconds. It took him, like, 4 hours to get that scene right. And he was talking about the book, like, to, in comparison, the iconic D-Day sequence from Saving Private Ryan took a week, you know?
But there's just so many kind of really nice, sincere moments and The Disaster Artist that really inform what you see in the room. And what I think is interesting, looking at the room just by itself, without the whole context of The Disaster Artist, is watching a man write a script, because from what I understand, he hadn't done any script work prior to that. And his idea of, this is what this movie should look like. Now, when you watch The Disaster Artist, it's all about the fact that Tommy doesn't want to be a villain. He's told by a casting director that he's the perfect villain. He can't be the hero. He doesn't look like a hero. So this whole notion of, well, I'm going to go and do what I want the way that I want it. The way the character of the main character of The Room is framed, and Lisa especially. When you look at how these characters are introduced to the audience, how they are developed, you really get a sense of some kind of persecution mania that Tommy Wiseau has ingrained in him, because you see how he paints the character that he plays.
Oh, yeah. He's and absolutely perfect in every way. Has a hot girlfriend.
Yeah.
He even shows off his body in the movie. You even see his butt in the film.
A lot. So,
yeah, a lot of butt. And everybody loves him, and it's everybody betrays him at the end.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, we were all just nicer to Johnny, who's just such a great, flawless individual.
Yeah, but, and then the counterpoint to that is how they characterize Lisa. She it's a very strange character, because this is supposed to be the person that Tommy Wiseau's character is in love with, who he will eventually, spoiler alert, kill himself because he loses her. So it has to be a character that it's believable that this is his life, because he said, "Oh, you're my life, Lisa." But at the same time, she's a horrible person.
Like, no redeemable qualities.
No, I mean, she's just terrible. Yeah, she's, I guess she's hot. If that's your
Lisa,
kind of thing.
You're so sexy.
You're so sexy. But the things that she does to Wiseau's character are so heinous. The whole telling people that he hits her when he never would do that. The whole thing about telling him that she was pregnant, and then she
just made it up to make it interesting.
That's her rationale. She's like, this is gonna, you know, it just looks like she is the worst of the wicked witches that you could possibly imagine. That she's just in it to totally wreck this guy's life, when all he's ever done is support her. I mean, we never see her. She doesn't really have, maybe she does have a job.
She mentions briefly about she has a client she has to talk to on the phone or something.
But again, and then that's Tommy Wiseau's wonderful screenwriting. You know, we don't have that fleshed out. We have no idea. You know, pretty much it seems like all she does is kind of hang out at home, drink wine with her friends, hang out with her mom, go shopping.
Tommy Wiseau really gets women, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. He's a feminist, you know. He's definitely on that Time's Up movement that we see going on in Hollywood right now. Because it's just, and you don't, I would want to know this from the Disaster Artist. Do they ever talk about Tommy having relationships with women?
In the book, he doesn't really date anybody, or he's never really with anybody. Okay. But he treats Juliet Danielle, who was Lisa in the movie, horribly. They show it a bit in the Disaster Artist when they're shooting the love scene, and like he's going, you know, he's looking at some, she has like a couple spots or something on her back.
Yeah.
He goes, this is disgusting. We can't have this. Like, he actually said that right in front of her face.
Yeah.
And he actually, reading for the auditions for the role of Lisa, he actually had a couple of the women make out with him just to see if they could get the part. I think he even did that with Lisa too.
Hashtag me too.
Yeah. I mean, he's, and even, one of the women who were just briefly appears like an extra during one of the party scenes, he like, "Look, Missy, this is not how we shoot movie scene. You do not talk like this to me," or something. He doesn't really, you can tell he doesn't really have a good viewpoint on women.
Yeah, I mean, the montage that they have in The Disaster Artist about how they were casting the role of Lisa is pretty funny. I mean, it's taken kind of lightly, and some of the things they have these women doing and saying are so kind of ridiculous, and that they're willing to do it, and then, you know, that just makes him so happy. So there's so much manipulation going on there, but it does kind of make me wonder, since, again, as you mentioned, everybody betrays Tommy by the end of The Room, and how, again, this persecution mania that I think Tommy Wiseau has, and you see this sort of develop a bit in The Disaster Artist, because you see Greg Sestero run into Bryan Cranston and, you know, have this part kind of given to him for a lumberjack, which means he has to cut his beard off, and Tommy's like, "No, you can't do that, no." And just how controlling Tommy Wiseau is, you know, he gets really bent out of shape when Greg gets a girlfriend and then wants to move out. It's just, but I never got the sense that Wiseau was a homosexual. I never saw that as being like a, and maybe they elaborated on the book.
It's kind of,
but
you don't really know. I mean, kind of like borderline homoerotic, I would say. It seems like he latches on to Greg a lot.
Yes, he does.
And he even had, like, even in the book, like, he has him stay at his L.A. hotel. And just like even in the movie, the mom's like, why are you staying in this guy's hotel that you know briefly?
Yeah.
You know, and she thinks Tommy, everybody tells him, like, why are you hanging out with this guy? This guy's a freak, you know?
Yeah, right.
So there is a bit of that, but it's like never really goes further, but.
Yeah, it doesn't, because it doesn't seem to me, it seems to me more like they're brothers, which is why it's so very interesting in The Disaster Artist that you have two real life brothers
playing
these two characters. And maybe because of that, that came out a little bit more to me as a brotherly relationship than anything, because it doesn't ever seem like Tommy is sexually interested in Greg.
But maybe the fact that he does control him so much.
Yeah,
when Greg gets a girlfriend and he's moving out, he gets really jealous. Like, I thought we were friends, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it seems more like, okay, so now he's got to, like, split custody with Greg because Greg has this girlfriend now. Tommy's always got to be the center of attention. And you see that from the very first time you see him in the Disaster Artist movie where he's doing...
Streetcar Named Desire. Stella!
Yeah, and Stella. He's like crawling over things and climbing up parts of the stage, and it's absolutely mesmerizing.
Yeah.
I remember reading
that in the book,
and
I was like, oh, they have to do this in the movie. You have to do it, and I loved it when they did it in the movie.
Yeah, and it's great, and the scene where they go to the diner to do the scene
which really happens
together,
too. Yeah.
And just... I think Tommy, in a lot of ways, especially in the beginning of their relationship, seems to be a very good force for Greg Sestero.
In the book, that's what Greg talks about, because I think the main criticism of going to the Disaster Artist, the movie, is I think it sort of lets Tommy Wiseau off the hook.
Oh, okay.
Because he's really manipulative in the book, and they show it. I think my main criticism of the movie is they go soft on him. They only show it a little bit. There's one scene in the book. Greg has this one friend, and he talks to his friend about Tommy sometimes. And the friend's like, "Yeah, this guy's weird. You shouldn't hang out with him sometimes." But anyway, that friend calls his apartment, but Tommy picks up.
Okay.
And then the guy says, "Oh, you must be Tommy," and that's all he says. But you know, like even in the movie, they talk a little bit how Tommy says, "Don't talk about me. Don't tell anybody about the class about me." He's extremely secretive to, like, you know, absolute extremes where he just doesn't want anybody to know anything about him.
Right.
And when he figures out this, he takes Greg out for a car ride, and they drive out in the middle of nowhere. And he's yelling at him, he's like, "Why did you do this to me, Greg?" You know, everything. And he tells him to get out of the car in the middle of nowhere, and he drives off.
Oh.
But he comes back and picks him up, but to the part where Greg's breaking down crying, and he does kind of a lot of things like that where he gets jealous, he yells a lot at Greg. One time Greg was invited to a party by this one friend, and the guy knocks on the door at his apartment, and then Tommy's like, who is that, Greg, you know, and he's screaming at him. And he does that a lot in the movie, and he's really, even during the filmmaking, he's even more of a jerk. And I think that's why I say the movie really lets him off the hook. It seems like they had to have Tommy Wiseau's approval, so they couldn't make him look too bad. And it seems like they kind of let him off. Because Wiseau, he does some stuff that's kind of creepy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I haven't read the book, but it really does come across, at least it came across to me, that there's something seriously wrong with Wiseau. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to see The Room to kind of know that, but... knowing the story behind it, I think really lends itself to trying to figure out how this movie got made in the first place and the kinds of things that you see happen in it. The fact that Danny is kind of like the surrogate child of Lisa.
But he's like way older. He's supposed to be like 18 years old, but he looks like he's like 25.
Yeah, and the guy even says it when he's cast. He's like, I'm
26.
20. Yeah. And they're like, "Well, you're gonna be this age," and you know how everybody comes to their place to hang out. to have sex, and it's totally cool with, yeah, with Tommy, and Tommy's just gonna take care of everyone and foster and nurture people, and you know, Lisa's mom absolutely loves him, and you know, he's so great.
I love in the movie how all the conversations that Lisa and her mom have are the exact same point.
Yeah.
I don't love John anymore, but you should marry him too because it's for financial security or whatever. And it's just the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. And because if you're mildly interested, you should watch The Room. You should watch Disaster Artist, but you should also watch Nostalgia Critic's breakdown of The Room, because he literally at one point says the lines before the characters say it in the sequence, and he's just like, cause you can see it by now, because it's the exact same thing, right? Like what you just said, they say the exact same thing like three or four times throughout the movie. The conversation doesn't change, and you find out during the course of these conversations that the mother has breast cancer, and it's just kind of glossed
up
over,
ever again.
You know? Yeah, and you wonder, okay, now why did Tommy Wiseau put that in, and then not do anything with it?
And you make the woman who's the old lady suffering from breast cancer as a villain. You know?
Yeah, yeah, but it was another part of Disaster Artist that I thought was really interesting was that actress, and maybe they talk more about this in the book, but. You know, she's married and her husband, and she's retired and everything, and her husband takes care of her. And Greg is sitting there, they're having lunch, and he's just like, what are you doing here? Why are you doing this? You know, you're pretty much taken care of. You know, why are you working on this set? And she gives kind of the perfect movie line of, well, a bad day on a set is better than any other job. And it was just, there's just little kind of moments like that in the Disaster Artist that are so incredibly sincere, that it's very difficult to hate Tommy. It's very difficult to dismiss so much of what is obviously wrong with The Room, because these people really are genuinely trying.
Yeah, and the thing is, with The Room, the Disaster Artist, I wish in the movie they would go into more detail about all the other characters. They focus mainly on Greg and Mark. I mean, Greg and Tommy, but they don't really focus on anybody else. Like with Claudette, the actress who played Claudette, she was this retired actress. They talk about in the movie briefly how she drove like 50 miles just to go to the set. And like even in the movie, they talk about like, and that happened where she passed out because Tommy was too cheap to pay for air conditioning even though it was like, you know, they're shooting this in the middle of summer in California.
Right. And he shows up late.
Yeah, he showed up late. He would show up late every day. Like,
wow.
Everybody be on set by 9 o'clock, and she would show up like at 12 o'clock every day.
Wow.
And the funny thing, the costume designer lady, she knew his routine, so she wouldn't show up till like 11:30, and she never got caught by him once.
I'll bet. Yeah. But yeah, the fact that being on a set and not having the director there is also money. So it's kind of, it's a wonderful irony that he shows up late and is berating everybody because they're passing out from being so hot. And yet he's the one that's also costing the money that could very easily pay for the air conditioning because he's showing up so late.
Yeah, and was doing all that because the Raphael character was the DP, and they show him briefly in the movie, he got fired because he couldn't take Tommy Wiseau. And the second guy came in, and one day they were shooting a scene. He was talking about how the lighting wasn't working. And if he was asking for the lighting equipment or some other type of camera that can fix this. And he told him, like, look, I'll pay the bill, but I need this. Otherwise, the shots won't work. And he told him, I know this place. Here's the number. I'll give you them. Call them. You can get you the equipment. And just let, you know, and then we can shoot the scene. So day comes later. The DP guy comes to Tom. He's like, hey, did you call them? Did you get the stuff? And then Tommy goes, oh, I didn't. I called them, but they said they didn't have anything. And then the guy flips out. He goes, I called them. They have the equipment, and they told me that you never called them. And he flips out of him and calls him a liar, and that guy quit. So they had to get a third guy come in that he shoots later. But talking about that, he was too cheap to pay for air conditioning. And he treated actors terribly because there were in the beginning, the book, they don't talk about this at all in the movie, but Greg didn't want to do The Room. There was another guy that was being Mark, and there was actually another woman that was going to be Lisa. But Tommy didn't want those want them on the set. So instead of just like saying you're fired or whatever, he got Greg in and said, Greg is just going to be a consultant for the studio. He just gave up this weird random story, and then he just came up with random excuses for the one guy to get him fired so he can put Greg in there to play Mark. And the one woman, it was Lisa, one day she was complaining because it was a hot day, and she asked for some water. And then Tommy took a water bottle and threw it at her face and said, "You think you think you'll get water in Hollywood? No, you don't, princess," or something like that. So that's what I think that the movie just sort of lets him slide a little bit. And I think you got to, you just can't let him slide. He was kind of a jerk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a pathological liar. He does have, I totally believe he has a persecution complex. He's incredibly controlling. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things come through when you watch The Room. And obviously are highlighted more in the book, The Disaster Artist, than the film. But you see a couple of instances in the film, The Disaster Artist, where, like the time where they're out having drinks and celebrating, and Greg starts talking to a girl, and you know Tommy's out on the dance floor doing just this insane dance, and he kind of looks up and sees, oh, Greg's talking to a girl, and that's when they have to leave right then. It's just a litter of all those kinds of moments where Tommy is in total control, and there's really very little. And you look at, say, dysfunctional relationships, and people that study dysfunctional relationships. So it takes two to tango. You've got Greg, who is young, obviously, is more inexperienced. You see kind of his home life a little bit before he leaves. And he's there are times where there are half-hearted attempts for him to distance himself from Tommy, and then you get the final kind of distancing where they're completely and totally done, and it's not until the film comes out and Tommy sends the notice to Greg to try to get him to come, and how you have to have the limo come and pick them up and go around the block because there's not enough people outside and stuff like that. But Greg is very easily manipulated in this.
And that's my biggest problem with The Disaster Artist. First off, I do enjoy the movie. I'm gonna point out a lot of critiques, but overall, I really liked it. I think Franco was great, but I think as far as characterization of everybody else besides Tommy Wiseau, I think that's where the film sort of falters.
Okay.
Because with Greg Sestero, he wasn't that easily manipulated.
Okay.
I wasn't that huge a fan of Dave Franco as Mark Greg Sestero, because he's just kind of like a puppy dog in the movie. He didn't really want to do The Room. He knew it was a piece of crap. He didn't, because in the movie he's just like, oh yeah, Tommy, I'll do it. He was desperate. He wasn't getting a lot of acting jobs at that time, so he didn't really want to do it, but he said, well, I need the money, and Tommy's got a ton of money back then on this, so I'll take it. And he wasn't kind of like, you know, come on, Tommy, you're good, because all throughout the movie he's just like, you can do this. He just didn't really want to do the movie, but he was more concerned with the actors and actresses than he really was with Tommy Wiseau.
So he's actually the one that's more nurturing instead of Tommy.
Yeah.
And whereas in The Room, Tommy is the one that's the nurturer.
And even that whole, I thought that whole ending scene was kind of silly, where that's the premiere and that everybody's just going way over the top, like it's one of the midnight screenings of The Room.
Right.
Which in the premiere, everybody was just kind of like uncomfortable because it was so bad, but they didn't really want to say anything.
Right.
And so that's what it was. And Tommy wasn't quickly like, oh yeah, everybody, it was a comedy. It was totally meant to be a comedy. This is great. Everybody loved my movie. He was famously very pissed off when people were
talking. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because actually you're talking about the Nostalgia Critic. He actually demanded that YouTube take that video down. He had a big
kidding.
He had a big battle with the Nostalgia Critic for a while. They've eventually patched things up and Greg's and Tommy's liked it, but in the beginning he did not like anybody making fun of his movie. He had a very public meltdown.
Oh wow. Yeah. See, that would have been interesting to put in the movie, because the movie does have a very Hollywood ending where Tommy has gone out into the lobby. Greg follows him out because everybody, like you say, is just kind of over the top, uproariously laughing at the film. And in the very beginning of the film, they're talking about people like Hitchcock. They go to see James Dean, where James Dean died.
Which they did.
And so, you know, and Greg says to Tommy, you know, listen to them. They love it. Did Alfred Hitchcock's movies ever get this kind of reaction? Of course, I don't think Hitchcock would have liked a whole bunch of people laughing at his film. But, I mean, he's able to kind of turn it around for Tommy to see that there is some gain for this. Uh-huh. So the fact that that is the opposite of what happened in real life, you know, that's definitely Hollywood license.
Yeah.
You know, because you do want to see... I mean, and even the way the film begins, you have a lot of these little cameos of people giving snippets of interviews about what they think of the the room and you know how you know it's just this infamous thing.
Like we really care what like Kristen Bell or Adam Scott or J.J. Abrams think about the room. Like that beginning is like I don't care what you think. I'm not here to watch you.
Yeah, that's. I mean, there's a lot of vanity going on in this movie.
And even the whole thing with Bryan Cranston, he wasn't in that. He never met Greg during that time. That was the whole thing where he was getting a shot.
Really?
In Malcolm in the Middle. No, it's just because James Franco likes Bryan Cranston, I guess. That was the whole point.
Wow.
It's just, here are these celebrity cameos. Like, even the beginning, the acting teacher woman, that was Melanie Griffith.
Yeah, right.
The one who plays Iris Burton, the talent agent who picks up Greg, that was Sharon Stone. So here's just all these random celebrity cameos. Do they have a point? No, but here, look, here's Bryan Cranston, here's Sharon Stone, here's Melanie Griffith, here's all these people. And it's just like, I didn't care. Like,
well, I mean, I think it's really interesting to see these two films, because they are both... commentaries on Hollywood. I mean, whether you're looking at, you know, the independent film The Room and how The Room is trying to ape what a movie looks like, what a good movie looks like, and failing miserably at that. But it's very self-aware in the fact that if you watch it with that perspective in mind, like, let's watch someone who doesn't know how to make a movie that has a budget that real directors would probably have killed for in some cases, and how that is, again, trying to be a reflection of what is Hollywood, and then watching The Disaster Artist, which again is another kind of reflection of Hollywood, where you have people that are playing these bit parts that are stars, or at least were far more prominent, you know, in some parts of their careers, and how you have like the stars giving their opinions at the beginning, like, you know, J.J. Abrams, like you were saying, you know, that's another side of Hollywood, and it's commentary on what James Franco thinks of Hollywood. Because most of the time, James Franco works in a lot of independent film.
I remember watching Red Letter Media review of Disaster Artist.
Okay.
And they were talking about James Franco as a director, and they had a whole list of all the films he's directed, and they says, have you heard of any of these movies?
Yeah, I mean, he does. I mean, and you see this every once in a while with certain actors where they will do all kinds of amazing independent work, or even in this case nowadays, working on television, and then they'll do a turn, like Laura Dern being in the latest Star Wars movies, so that, you know, she can go and make another movie with David Lynch or something like that. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, and James Franco has been in movies that have been, you know, decent box office performers, but for the most part, you know, he's kind of on the fringe. So again, it's another commentary on Hollywood.
I just saw it more of he likes to put his friends in his movies. It's
definitely true with Seth Rogen, my God.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Those two work together on this movie, and that's usually how I avoid a lot of those comedies, because they always just seem like dumb stoner comedies. And like that one movie they did, it was called like This Is the End or everything, and it's about they're playing themselves, and they're in Hollywood. It's just like during this apocalyptic event.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And it's just like it. It's just not interested, because I don't care that you're good friends with these people. I don't care.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, he's done, like, James Franco did an adaptation of As I Lay Dying, which is a William Faulkner novel.
And he also did The Sound and the Fury.
Yeah, and he's going to be doing, I think he's already done it, because he was someplace where he had the tattoo on the back of his head, and his head was shaved, but Zeroville, which is a really great novel, which is also a commentary on Hollywood.
And he also did I think he directed a biopic about Sal Mineo, who was the kid from Rebel Without a Cause.
So, I mean, here's somebody who definitely loves movies and loves Hollywood, and he's a brilliant, brilliant guy who could then turn around and do something like, what was the name of the film about North Korea?
Oh, the interview?
Yeah, the interview. So his choices are very interesting, and I definitely cannot fault him for that. But you're right. There is a lot of include your buddies sort of thing going on, which seems like it's turning you off.
Yeah, it's just sort of like, look how cool we are because we're all famous celebrities. And I just that always just kind of gets on my nerves. It seems like just a little bit smug.
Well, for me, I can't stand Seth Rogen.
Yeah, me neither.
So, but I didn't mind him in The Disaster Artist. He was less Seth Rogen-y.
Yeah, but he was more of just kind of like, here's me commentating about all the silly stuff in the room. Like, here's me commentating about how god-awful that love scene is.
Yeah.
Here's me commentating about about the fact that Claudette's breast cancer is never brought up again in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Here's me caught up of like, why don't we just use the actual alleyway instead of this prop alleyway, you know?
So he's kind of almost like the voice of reason in the background that says, you know,
this is ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. But then again, he's sort of the authority there because nobody else really knows what they're doing. So to me, that doesn't rub me the wrong way because
I didn't hate it or anything. Yeah. It was just kind of like, he didn't really do much for me.
Yeah, it could have been anybody. Yeah, kind of like I'm bitter about the Tom Hardy being the pilot in Dunkirk. Where everybody's just like, oh, Tom Hardy. I love Tom Hardy. And all you see is his eyes, and he's really not in there very much. And it's just like, why did you waste Tom Hardy? In this case, you can waste Seth Rogen, that's okay, but it literally could have been anybody in that role, and you would have had similar results.
That's the thing. Like, this movie is one of the things Red Letter Media talked about was they talked about how Ed Wood, which is similar to this movie, is a much better film, and I have to agree. And one thing they talked about is how they kind of give not just Ed Wood, which is played by Johnny Depp, a character, but they give everybody. They played Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi, a great character, Academy Award-winning performance.
Right.
Sarah Jessica Parker was pretty good in that movie. Also, was the other one was Patricia Clarkson. I know, yeah, that was her name. Or Patricia
Arquette.
Arquette, okay.
Yeah.
And even Bill Murray, you know, the problems he's having with that movie with the sex change operation, all the stuff he's going through. And everybody's got a little bit of a story. And this movie, all the other supporting characters don't have depth. And they could. They talk a little bit about Claudette and what she went through, but Juliette Danielle was actually supporting her entire family with this movie.
I didn't know that.
She was supporting a lot of people. She had a family. And she was doing this because she needed the money and she had to support her, like her mom or somebody. And they could have talked about that. They could have even talked about like what she was going through when she had to shoot those really god-awful love scenes with Tommy Wiseau. And then in the real life, she talked about how she thought that was just going to be some quick little snippet of like 5 or 10 seconds. And then she was watching that scene with her parents. And then she was just, oh my God.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have seen that, like to see what she was going through. But once again, like you said, you could have put, I don't even know who the actress was in that movie.
I don't either.
You could have put any random actress in that role and it wouldn't have made any difference because you didn't really give her anything to do.
Well, and that's another thing too about that movie is that you are trying to cast people that look like real life people. So I don't know, given how many people James Franco does know in Hollywood, he probably could have gotten somebody.
The big names, yeah.
And didn't. But I think, and I don't know how much I would attribute this to James Franco itself, but because the movie is so about Tommy Wiseau, and that's probably what the majority of people that have seen The Room and are going to see The Disaster Artist want to see.
Yeah.
Whereas Ed Wood is more historical person, so setting him back in that time period and also giving other characters for us to kind of get interested in is more about the contextualizing and what we learn more about Ed Wood, whereas with The Disaster Artist, you see, you know, it's just mostly Greg and Tommy. But I mean, Ed Wood is probably one of the best movies I've seen about what it takes to make a movie.
Yeah, everybody who, like, would want to make a movie should watch Ed Wood.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the sincerity, I think, is something that is a very similar thing to Ed Wood because, of course, Ed Wood's movies are considered to be some of the worst movies of all time. And when you look at, say, the directing style of what we see in Ed Wood and the way Johnny Depp plays, and he's like, no, cut, good, well, let's move on to the next scene, let's keep going, versus the Tommy Wiseau 42,000 takes of one thing because he can't get it. Mm-hmm. You can see, you know, obviously two very different approaches to directing style. And that's also kind of interesting too. So I would actually say watching Disaster Artist and Ed Wood together gives you two very different pictures of two different versions of Hollywood, but also gives you a little bit of insight as to, you know, what it takes to make a movie, even if it's like, you know, the sets are so, our sets are like basically cardboard and, you know, the kinds of things that you see in the Ed Wood movie where they're using like headlights in order to try to be the lights for a particular scene that's an exterior shot where, you know, Bela Lugosi is trying to fight an octopus.
I love that scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene. But yeah, I think what I think is really interesting about the Disaster Artist is that you can get a really pretty good psychological picture of Tommy Wiseau that adds to the things that are already evident in what you see in the room.
Yeah, and Franco's really good in the movie. That's one of the
He's
outstanding. Like, as of this recording, he won the Golden Globe last night for best performance in a comedy. And he totally deserves it. And when I heard about the film, I was like, oh, he's not just going to do a Tommy Wiseau impression throughout, like what I'm doing right now, Mark, like something like that.
Right.
He's actually giving a lot of depth, and that's the strong point of the movie for me.
Yeah, I think Frank, and I'm very happy that he won, because when you look at the people that he was up against, those movies did far more box office. I don't really think a ton of people are going to see the Disaster Artist. Well, they might do it more now since he won that award. But, you know, there's not a lot of people that want to go and see a movie about the worst movie of all time, and there's not a lot of people that have seen The Room and want to sit down and watch the worst movie of all time in order to better understand a movie that they're going to go pay money to see. So the fact that the Hollywood Foreign Press recognized the caliber of the performance that James Franco gave, because it's incredibly nuanced. I mean, there's never a time in the movie that I felt that Wiseau was being denigrated in any way.
Does them perfectly.
Yeah, and I think I saw an interview where Franco was talking about how much of himself that he sees in Tommy Wiseau, because again, he does a lot of directing in independent films, and, you know, he just talks about, you know, this is how passionate Wiseau was, this is how passionate I am about doing movies. So I am really impressed that A, got nominated, and B, won.
Yeah, and I think the other credit I can give to this movie, like for example with Ed Wood, you can tell Tim Burton didn't just want to mock Ed Wood.
Right.
When he made the movie, and he had a lot of heart. Like, Tim Burton in a way probably really appreciates those movies, even though they're terrible.
Yeah.
And the same thing I will say, like, I wouldn't say Franco's direction in this film was outstanding, but it's okay. It's solid.
Yeah.
And he actually you can tell there's a lot of heart, that he really appreciates The Room. He loves it. And like, both as an honor, I would say, to this movie, and a bit of a criticism, it's like a really big budget fan film of The Room.
Yeah.
Let's recreate these scenes. Let's show you how it made. And we're going to give you all the little moments you remember, like, you know, the Oh Hi Mark scene, all the other little other classic scenes from the movie.
Yeah, and the evidence is there at the end of the movie. Once the movie finishes, you see a side-by-side comparison of several of the sequences in the movie. And then you're kind of crinkling your nose up at that. You didn't seem to like that.
It's sort of like, that's something I wouldn't mind seeing on like a special features on the DVD or Blu-ray. It's like, you don't need to throw it in at the end. It's like, we get it. You were trying to recreate The Room. Here are the moments we remember most from that movie. It just seems a little bit tacked on that you got to throw it in. Like, if I want to see that, I'll check it out on the special features on the Blu-ray.
So I saw this movie over Christmas, and I was in a theater. It was probably the smallest theater in the multiplex that I was at, and it was packed. Mm-hmm. And half, you could tell that half the room had seen The Room and the other half didn't. And the people that were really into it and laughing and having a good time were clearly the people that have seen The Room.
Yeah.
And when you had all throughout the movie, when they do the different scenes and you see them blocked out and shot and the commentary of you know, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And then that end sequence, and people loved it.
Really?
People were really excited. And it's kind of funny, because for the people that had seen The Room, they were still sitting and watching that. And the people that hadn't seen The Room were already getting up and leaving.
Oh, really?
So it was kind of like, there really is kind of a delineation between the people that know what the movie is about already and the people that don't. That's why I'm saying, like, they're not going to make a lot of money on this movie. Mm-hmm. If you probably do the tallies and totals, Tommy Wiseau's The Room probably is going to end up making more money for Tommy Wiseau than The Room will for James Franco. Because, again, it's just an insanely niche thing. The fact that A24 made it in the first place kind of boggles my mind.
I will say, though, this is one of the biggest cult movies of all time, The Room.
Right.
So anybody who likes that movie and who has seen it, you know they're going to go see The Disaster Artist.
Right.
Like, I remember when it was announced that they were making the movie, and I'm like, this is my most anticipated movie of 2017. I'm going to go see this thing.
Yeah. And for the people that are in the know, but I think overall, that's a very small portion of a movie-going mm-hmm. audience. You know, when you compare it to how many people are fans of Star Wars and how many people go and see Star Wars, a layperson will go and see Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I don't know if a layperson will.
Your average person who just kind of goes movies for, you know, during their spare time, not a huge film buff,
right.
probably won't care to see this movie, but you know they'll go see the new The Last Jedi or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of person that, you know, goes to on Tuesdays when it's like $5.50 and they're looking at the marquee and they're looking at all the posters and they're looking at the poster for The Disaster Artist and going,
What the hell is that?
Yeah. We might see a little more notoriety for this movie because of this award. And I think that's great. But I also know at the same time, like, my mom and my whole family actually went to see The Greatest Showman the night that I went and saw The Disaster Artist. And they went home, but my mom stayed behind, and she actually came in at the end of the movie right when Tommy Wiseau goes out into the lobby, and, you know, Greg is talking to him about, listen to the people and stuff. And she saw the side-by-side comparisons, and I'm like... And she heard all the people in the movie theater laughing and stuff, and she just, like, clearly was like, I don't get what this is going on.
It's one of those things where you either get it or you don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it would be really, if you like movies, you should see The Room if you haven't already done so. And there's a free version on YouTube right now if you can just, like, skip the It's Spanish subtitled, but it is for free out there, so you can watch it. It's not very long. It's like an hour and 37
hour and
minutes.
Half,
yeah. And see The Disaster Artist, because if you love movies, you will get a lot of what's going on. But I can see that there's really not a huge audience, I think, for this movie. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not trying to be The Last Jedi.
No, not at all.
No, it's a very specific movie with some motivations behind it that are very clear, and it's not trying to appeal to the largest common denominator, and that's okay too. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look at the kinds of movies that were up for awards at last night's Golden Globes, Frances McDormand, I think, was... No, Sam Rockwell, when he won for Best Supporting Actor for 3 Billboards, when in his acceptance speech, said something like, "Wow, it's really refreshing because I do so many independent films that I'm in one that people actually went and saw." and it's very true when you look at, you know, Dunkirk and how much money that has made and how much money it took to make that movie, and you look at something like 3 Billboards, and there's a lot in the marketplace this year. I think it was a fairly good year for movies.
As far as quality goes.
Yeah, as far as quality goes. I mean, you still have the blockbusters out there that are going to pull in the ridiculous sums of money, but there was a lot of variety too. I mean, you had Get Out. Look at Get Out and look at how successful that was. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So if you like movies, I think you would like to have a double feature of The Room and Disaster Artist, because there's things there for you that are going to be of interest to you. Mm-hmm. And Tommy Wiseau is just a fascinating person.
Definitely. And I do want to bring up a little bit. Have you seen any of his other works, Tommy Wiseau?
No.
No. And he did, I know I haven't seen this one, but he did a web series, kind of a little tiny web series. It was called Neighbors. So it's like this wacky comedy about all these people that live in this apartment complex together. And I just haven't had much interest in seeing it because everybody says he's trying too hard. It's one of those things where, you know, like he didn't, you know, now he's just trying to recap, you know, he's too self-aware of how bad he is.
He's done one thing, and now he's trying to recreate. Yeah,
but still, he's the one thing he's done, I always find fascinating about him, is this one thing he's done, which he failed in every possible way, is become this huge worldwide phenomenon where he's still, to this day, he's touring this movie around the world.
Yeah.
It's not just America.
Yeah.
It's in Europe. It's like in Africa. It's like in Asia places.
Yeah.
He's going everywhere with this movie. He did one movie, and it's going to set him for life, even though he did everything wrong, and it was completely unintentional.
Yeah, and the fact that, I mean, he was on stage with James Franco at the Golden Globes. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine this guy, who is one of the worst filmmakers ever, was on the stage at the Golden Globes.
Recognizes the excellence of the year of the best movies and TV.
I mean, he's standing in front of a room full of the most talented people in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
He's standing in front of them. And I mean, it's like the most ultimate irony. I think it's great that Franco, A, invited him, and B, brought him up on stage.
I always find the Golden Globes and the Academy Awards insufferable to sit through. But if they had him on stage and talking, and he just talked for like 5 minutes about whatever, I would have so watched it.
Yeah. He tried to talk, and Franco just kind of pushed him away.
Like that would make me watch it. I wouldn't watch it for anything else but that.
But it was fascinating to see him in front of, I mean, like Oprah Winfrey was winning the Cecil B. DeMille Award. He's standing right in front of one of the most powerful in Steven Spielberg's table with the posters over here.
Hi, Oprah.
With Meryl Streep. And I mean, it's just like, it was sublime and surreal. It just was crazy that he would be standing in front of those people.
He's achieved the dream.
He is the dream.
He is, like, if anybody's listening, we get some foreign listeners. If you want to come to this country,
yep.
You look at Tommy Wiseau.
Yep.
He made a terrible movie. He financed it, so he built himself up from the ground, able to get $6 million to make his own movie, did it absolutely terrible, and yet he's become an international phenomenon. If you can do it too, if you come to this country, whatever your dream is, you can do it too.
You could come here and fail so hard and be successful.
Yes.
So just, you know, just take him, because it is inspiring. I mean, it's a weird thing to say,
but...
Because he is sick. He's really, there's things wrong with Tommy Wiseau.
Definitely.
But it to see what happened because of what he did is stunning. I mean, if you go on YouTube and type in The Room, there are dozens of people that have done video commentary. The Red Letter Media, I think, actually did a commentary track.
Yep, they did a commentary track
for The Room. And it's just like, so much content for this one awful thing. And people won't stop talking about it. And the fact that they got a movie made of it is yet another just mind-blowing thing. But it's something that is possible. I mean, Ed Wood never had this kind of success.
No, at least not until, like, after he died.
Right.
And even Red Letter Media also did a review of Ed Wood recently. And they talked about how later in his life he died, went through rehabilitation because he was an alcoholic and he was penniless, and they actually show him later on in life and he's just out of it mentally. And it's sad.
Yeah. I mean, if things worked logically, that would be Tommy Wiseau.
Mm-hmm.
But in the internet age, in the social media age,
everything just catches quicker.
Yeah.
If Ed Wood was alive now,
yeah,
he would be a huge star.
Right. I mean, it's just fascinating to see what has become. I mean, this is also not just a commentary on Hollywood, but a commentary on our culture and what we do with things and the love that we have of the it's so bad, it's good. I mean, before the VCR age, you didn't have anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And even like we keep talking about Red Letter Media, they do a show called The Best of the Worst.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they do a roundtable discussion of all these, like they watch 3 or 4 really bad movies and they discuss them. And like that's bringing awareness to all these bad movies that maybe 20, 30 years ago we wouldn't have even heard of.
Right, or like Miami Connection that we've talked about before. Again, another movie that was made by people that really didn't know what they were doing, but was incredibly sincere. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, YK Kim goes around to Alamo Draft Houses and stuff
and
like that.
They have
that.
The band playing, the Dragon Sound.
Yeah,
playing.
You can go in, go to the website and download Against the Ninja, and you can get a vinyl soundtrack. I mean, it's just like it's almost a cottage industry in and of itself. Who Killed Captain Alex? You know, we're actually starting to export that to other countries now. You can actually have success. They need to bring him over here.
Oh, definitely.
I just would be amazed to see if he had a $6 million budget like Wiseau did for this movie. Mm-hmm. Imagine what that would look like.
Oh, it'd be great.
It would be awesome. So yeah, this in and of itself is fascinating. The book, the movie, the original source material. You can learn a lot if you're a film student. You can learn a lot by looking at this content. Not necessarily how not to do something, but to see people putting the parts of a movie together. And when you look at The Room, you know, there were a couple of times where I was watching and I was like, you know, this isn't completely incompetent. I mean, the
landscape shots are okay.
I mean, there's just some of the stuff that I was just like, well, you know, this isn't too bad. Then of course something happens and you're like, yeah, it is that bad. Yeah. But it's like every once in a while, it's like, you know, the soundtrack isn't completely horrible.
It's your typical stock music.
Yeah, it's not invasive. You know, I just saw The Post, and as much as I love John Williams, it's just like every once in a while I'm getting too much telegraphed information from the soundtrack, and I didn't have that problem in The Room. And John Williams has won multiple Academy Awards for best score. So, you know, there's things to take away from The Room and The Disaster Artist that I think if you really like film, you should definitely look at them because they're fascinating.
All right, then. So then I'm going to wrap this up. The last question I'll have is tell us a little about your classes you got coming up in the spring.
So I have three. I have Humanities 101, which is online. And that's just it's a very massive class. It's covering all of humanities as human beings have been alive. So it's thousands of years of art and music, and you know, the last bit of class actually gets the movies in. Film 101, which is like the different aspects of filmmaking, cinematography, sound, directing. And film 171, which is Introduction to American Cinema, which looks at the history of American cinema from like the late 1800s to today.
Okay, well, that wraps up this week's episode of Armchair Directors. We have been talking about greatest movie of all time, The Room, directed by me, Tommy Wiseau, and the film it inspired, The Disaster Artist, directed by James Franco. Don't forget you listen to the Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under category Armchair Directors. Oh, hi, Professor Dutter. I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
That's a funny story.
What a story. For Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Tommy Wiseau, saying, you are tearing me apart, Lisa!